Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. The Kushnama is unique, literally. Only one copy of the Epic of Kush exists, sitting in the British Library. Hardly anything is known about its author, Iran Shah. It features a quite villainous protagonist, the Tusk warrior Kush, who carves a swath of destruction across the region. And the tale spans nearly half the world, with episodes in Spain, the Maghreb, India, China, and even Korea. It was that last reference that encouraged academics in Korea to study the Kushnama and bring Kaveh Hemat to do its first ever English translation, published by the University of California Press earlier this year. Kaveh Hemat is a professor, professional faculty in history at Benedictine University, a scholar of world history and Islamic culture, and director of the NEH-funded Kateneme Translation Project. He completed his PhD at the University of Chicago in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations in 2014. His research focuses on interaction between the Islamic world and East Asia and the importance of this interaction to Islamic political thought and pre-modern global political history. Today, Kaveh and I discuss this unique document, the Kushnama, and the cultural and political context behind its writing. So, Kaveh, thank you so much for joining me on the Asian Review Books podcast today. You know, perhaps I'd like to start with what exactly is the Kushnama, the Epic of Kush? What is this work? When was it written? Where did you find it?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. I think you started with the hardest question, or at least I'm inclined to take it that way. It's an epic, right? And I think we can say that pretty unproblematically, but it's a Persian epic written in between 1108 and 1111, Common Era, and it's an epic of an anti-hero, right? The title character and the principal character in the epic is a really bad guy, and so it was because one of the important settings in the epic is this insular paradise, this island called Basila, or we don't really know how the vowels are, were meant to be pronounced. It could be Basila, Bosila, but anyway, I've used Basila because that just seems easier, it flowed off the tongue better. Because one of the main settings in this epic is this insular paradise, Basila, which is a corruption of Sila, the dynastic, an older dynastic name for Korea. It attracted the attention of researchers in Korea, Professor Hee-Soo Lee, namely. And so he started, he had a big Korean government-funded project to research this epic. And I was invited on to translate it. They wanted to produce, they produced a Korean translation of parts of it. And they wanted to produce a full English and also Chinese translation. So I was invited to do this. I think mostly because of my interest in East Asia, Islamic world interactions. It's my first attempt at translating something anywhere near this size. That's how I got started on it.
What's Iran, or I guess Persia, what's this part of the world like when this epic was written? Kind of what's the state of its culture, its politics? Kind of what is the, I guess, what's the state of Persia at this time?
Sure. So, one thing I'm sure a lot of readers or listeners will be familiar with is that, national boundaries, national borders don't look anything, don't exist back then, right? But there are regional identities, and, there's a good case to be made that some elements of, what eventually became Iranian national consciousness are rooted in the Sasanian Empire that was around from the 200s to the 600s AD, right? So in the 1100s, after the Arab conquest or the Islamic conquest eliminated the Sasanian Empire and took over a lot of the better territories of the Roman Empire, you have this big, in some ways cosmopolitan, empire with Arabic as this new language, and it has governed this big area, right, the caliphate, for now hundreds of years. And in the 900s, you start to get a political or a resurgence of, you know, what you could call Iranian, for lack of a better term, Iranian political identity, right? People who, local rulers, the caliphs are getting weaker, local rulers start claiming to be, you know, descended from, the Sasanian kings. And Ferdowsi's great epic of kings, the Shahnameh, is written. It's completed in 1010. And the Persian language, New Persian, is coming back into use, right? So they've started writing Persian, the Persian language, a form of Persian. They're different Persian languages. They started writing it in the Arabic alphabet with a lot of Arabic loanwords. Actually, interestingly, the oldest New Persian document we have was a letter written by Jews in Central Asia, right? So, you know, we know that it was, you know, it was not just the language of Muslims and not just, you know, well, Iranians is obviously a flexible term. Certainly Jews could be Iranian back then, or Persian speakers, but it wasn't just Zoroastrians. And so by now, fast forward 100 years to the 1100s, and you've got the Seljuk Empire, right? A dynasty with origins in Central Asia, right, who speak Turkic languages, has come in and basically, and there had been Turkic military slaves or slave soldiers before who came in, and their, you know, their freedmen descendants became powerful rulers. But now you've got the Seljuk state, big, you know, empire takes over kind of the whole Middle East. And that's the political environment he's writing in. Besides that, I mean, I don't know, is that the political environment's important here, because epics, this epic tradition is highly political. Besides that, I mean, you're looking at a period when you're passing from an era when Islam and the states that govern the Islamic world have this really clear connection to the community of Muhammad and his followers. You're going from that kind of a situation to one where they really need to, you know, redefine and create now, an Islamic state, right, as it were, from scratch, right? You don't have people who can say, oh, I'm a descendant of, you know, so-and-so going back to Muhammad. You can't have people who can claim to be caliphs. And so there's all these attempts to define what is, you know, to write about justice and governance and what is a just society, and to kind of recover the bases of, you know, identify the basis of spiritual or, you know, religious authority, right? Religio-political authority. Of course, they're all mixed up. And of course, at the same time, right, what you could say is Iran and Central Asia. And by the way, when I'm talking about Iran here, or Persia, Persia would be just kind of southwestern Iran, right? But you have the Iranian plateau, right, which is basically the modern day country of Iran. You have Iraq. The geographers back then used to refer to it as the two Iraqs, meaning what we now call Iraq, or most of what we now call Iraq. And kind of, I think, western Iran was the other Iraq, right? So, and then you have, or Persian-speaking Iraq is the way they described it, Iraq-e Ajam. And then you have present-day Afghanistan and present-day Uzbekistan in that area, Tajikistan, right? Turkmenistan, Central Asia. So all of that is the area we're talking about when we talk about the eastern territories of the caliphate and the area where the Persian language is being revived. And then, of course, within a couple hundred years, Delhi becomes a major, you know, starts to be a major center of Persian literary production, Delhi in South Asia. And I mean, putting this in a wider Asian context, of course, you can talk about the Song Dynasty's economic boom. And there is, you know, of course, maritime trade in this period is really famous, but there's also overland trade between the northern Song and its neighbors in Central Asia. So, yeah, how's that for a setting?
And there's a lot there that I want to get into. But maybe let's start with the idea that, you know, you're kind of talking about this is the emergence of, you can call it Persian, you can call it Iranian, like an identity forming. And one, it seems like this is the Epic of Kush is trying to create this kind of mythical history for that society. And I wonder if you might talk about what, I guess, what is this kind of history the Epic is trying to create?
Yeah, okay, that gets complicated. So first off, mythic is, you know, this is of course a term we apply now, and in some ways, people back then did think of some of these old stories as myths, or at least as unreliable. But it was very much understood as real history, right? Maybe not the story of Kush, that might have been debated, but the main kings in the Persian Epic of Kings, the Shahnameh. They're as real as the biblical prophets, right? They're in the distant past, right? But in a Abrahamic, you know, monotheistic framework, you can't, you know, of course the biblical prophets are real, right? So, you know, King Solomon, right? So they're one of the ways that people, but this question of, you know, how reliable are these old stories is a live one, right? So one of the ways that people sort of generate and renegotiate this Iranian identity in this time is by sort of looking at the kings that are supposedly the great ancestors, political, spiritual, or otherwise, of this Persian imperial tradition, and trying to line them up chronologically with the Abrahamic religion sort of historical accounts, the biblical tradition, the Quranic tradition. Where is Jamshid relative to Solomon, right? What prophets were around when he was alive? Was he in the time of Abraham? Was he in the time of, you know, of Noah? And so on, right? So there, you know, whether you can think of them as, you know, there's certainly this doubt about them, right? But they weren't treated as sort of the separate domain of fiction, right? They were real people, but maybe doubtful, right? Maybe doubtful. And yeah.
Well, let's talk about kind of one of these characters then. You know, you're the protagonist of the Kushnameh, Kush. You know, he is a character, to put it lightly. I mean, he's physically distinct. I mean, with his tusks, he's not a virtuous character, to put it mildly. Why do you think the story makes him one of its central characters? And I mean, and that could tie to the historical aspect of it, but I guess why put Kush front and center?
Well, and that's I think the $60,000 question, because, you know, if you look at the Shahnameh and you look at, you know, what one of the, a lot of classical Persian literature, a lot of the epic tradition specifically is taking these characters from, let's say, the narrative world of the Shahnameh and writing different stories about them, right? And those could be heroic epics like the Epic of Garshasp, right? Who's a hero who fights dragons and kills, you know, giants and monsters and enemies on the battlefield. They could be more in a romance sort of mold, right? So Khosrow and Shirin, you know, the story of Khosrow and Shirin becomes a whole epic that a later poet writes. But they're not anti-hero stories, right? That's not really something we have more than maybe, you know, one real other example of that I'm aware of. And it's... One theory is that this epic originally started out as stories that kind of delegitimized or demonized the Kushan Empire, who were enemies of the Sasanians back in the, you know, the 300s. The story originated there, and fast forward 700 years later, right, to the 1100s, and there's this, you know, this vogue for finding these old stories and kind of modernizing them, right? Rewriting them in verse, in New Persian. And that, you know, basically what the author had was this old story that other people hadn't written before. And he's like, okay, here's something fresh. Here's something new. Let's write this one. But there's other elements of it, right, that don't match, that I don't think are explained by that theory. They're not necessarily incompatible, but they're not explained, right? So Kush spends maybe two-thirds, a little under two-thirds of the epic as ruler in the East. But then there's a later part where he's ruler in the West, right? Where he becomes the king of Andalus, which is like basically Spain, Iberia, Portugal, as well as North Africa, right? So is that just an attempt to reconcile the biblical Kush, right? Father, I think, of Nimrod, with this other Kushan figure, right? What's going on here? And I don't think that just explaining it in terms of the sources is really satisfactory, because I think the author has a little bit of a bigger project here with exploring the meaning of the epic tradition of heroism, right, of kingship, and other themes, right? How does somebody become evil, right? Where does this, you know, this just incredibly evil figure, you know, why is he like that? Why are there monsters? So, yeah.
So, this is a good segue to kind of my next question, which is, these kind of discussions of where's evil come from, what does it mean to be a ruler, to be a king, what do you think? What was the epic designed to kind of give these moral lessons to? Maybe moral lessons is too strong a term, but kind of these moral ideas, these political ideas to its readers. So it wasn't just pure entertainment. Listen to all these historical battles, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's interesting because my feeling about this translating it, reading it and translating it was that it almost has kind of the pacing of, almost a high fantasy, right? Of where we don't know what's going to happen next, right? I mean, I think there's actually you could argue that there's a pretty substantial building of suspense. I think that maybe almost comes out clearer in a prose, paragraph format, prose translation than in the verse, but I think it comes across in the verse as well. That's something we'd say about the Shahnameh, right? That Ferdowsi is a consummate storyteller. So I'm gonna give this annoying academic answer and say that these things are all kind of really tied together, actually, right? That you can't separate, the narrative art from the morals, right? The aesthetics and the moral lessons are, inextricably tied. What's interesting is I think from that angle, I think more so than is the case probably anywhere else in the epic tradition, Iran Shah. By the way, I didn't talk about the author's name, right? But we don't actually know for sure who wrote it. There's some doubt as to whether Iran Shah is actually the author, and his name is spelled three different ways in the four manuscripts of the one book that that names him. Bearing that in mind, I think more than anywhere else in the epic tradition, you see in Iran Shah this interest in science, basically, right? And what makes an organism like a biological organism develop in a certain way, right? Why is a monster a monster, right? But I think that builds on this other discussion. Why are fish fish? Why are birds birds? This question of natures. Right, of a person having a fundamental nature or character that they tend not to deviate from, right? They tend to, that's I think sort of the main, the main thing that we see going on here, right? The main sort of dramatic axis, let's say, dramatic structure at the beginning is you have these, Kush and the descendants of Zahak, right? Who is the most evil king in the Shahnameh. And the Jamshidians, right? Descendants of Jamshid, descendants and followers of Jamshid, the glorious sun king who falls from grace because he claims to be divine. So I think it's, this is something that scholarship will need to explore, but I think that's kind of what this epic's about is, why do we treat some people as fundamentally good, right? And maybe not just people, maybe social groups, right?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, just because you mentioned the author, do we know anything about Iranshah, the poet who wrote the epic?
Really not a lot. He dedicates this to his the Seljuk ruler, Muhammad ibn Malik Shah. He just from the invocation, from the preface to the epic, you get the sense that he's been there under, in the court of the Seljuks and the courtly world of the Seljuks for some time. And he wrote an epic of Bahman. There is an extant Bahman-name, an epic of Bahman, who is, you could describe him as an anti-hero, but nowhere near on the level of Kush. He's not evil in that way. He's maybe more just misguided, vengeful. And there is, again, some doubt as to whether the extant Bahman-name is the one that he wrote. So we don't really know a lot else about him.
So I want to take a different tack for this next question. The book covers a wide geographic area. I mean, you mentioned it deals with China, it deals with Korea or some version of that, it deals with North Africa, it deals with Spain. And I guess, first of all, like, is that kind of wide geographic area, is that unique to the Kushnameh? And even if it's not, I mean, would we have expected readers to know a lot about, I guess, regions as far afield as Korea and Spain?
It depends on the reader, of course. and it depends on what we mean by knowing. That's a great academic answer, isn't it? But somebody who had read, who was interested in the subject of geography, certainly could have found information about Korea, but it would be very vague. Right, it would be okay. There's this place somewhere beyond China where merchants go and settle and they don't come back. Right. Well, that sounds like a myth of paradise. Right. That sounds like a traveler's tale. But it's very possible that actual traveler's lore, traveler's tales did bring back something a little bit more specific than that. Right. Oh yeah, there's a king there. His name is such and such, and that doesn't always make it into the geographies. Spain, much closer, right? Spain is, at this point, we've gone from a caliphate to kingdoms in Spain, right? And it's got a really long presence of Arabic Islamic culture. And it's, one thing that I notice Iranshah does is he seems to have really mined the geographies or just the geographical lore that people knew, right? Geographical knowledge that he had or that others had for pretty specific place names in Iberia, right? So he specifically, I think, seems to identify places that were just beyond the frontiers of the Islamic world, right? The furthest reaches of historical regions of Muslim rule, and identifies those as the places that Kush goes to conquer. So, for example, he goes to Jaqa. That's mentioned a few times, right? Jaqa is a principality kind of on the edge of the Pyrenees. He mentions Basque country a few times. And then places that are more mythical in character, right? There's a land of the beauties, right? So what's that? That's pretty vague and hard to identify. The king's name is Farouk, right? Which is a, you know, a nice Arabic name. But it's really interesting. You know, it's an interesting question about what he's doing with these names, right? Is he trying to show off his erudition of like, look, I know these, you know, exotic place names that you don't know? Is he picking places that don't have Arabic names and are well outside the domains of, sorry, the kind of sphere of Islamic rule in order to identify, to sort of say that Kush is going further, conquering further than, you know, the Arab conquerors, the Umayyads had conquered? Is he picking non-Muslim names as a way of, you know, creating a kind of, as a kind of antiquarianism, right? Is there a sense that these are sort of exotic or foreign names and they'll sound more, I don't want to say primitive, but more old, maybe, right? Older names, than if he identifies places that are more familiar, right? There's a kind of exoticism there. So, but I think there's a strong sense that he's using this, you know, this geographical knowledge to, for the purpose of characterization, right? Interestingly, his knowledge of, you know, his knowledge of China and other places is less, but he doesn't have as many specific place names within China, although of course he has Chang'an, you know, the big Tang dynasty capital, which is no longer the capital in this time. But yeah, I mean, this is a world where some of his readers at least will recognize these names. I mean, you got to assume that he's talking to people who, you know, who aren't going to be, I mean, we just kind of have to assume that, right? We don't know, but we know that they're in the geographies. So they could very well have known these place names. Yeah.
And what about Song China? I mean, you mentioned kind of Song China in your introduction. I mean, were there close connections between I guess Persia/Iran and China at this time?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's different types of connections. And I think the nature of the connections is the really interesting question because, so going back to the Abbasid period, right, to this from 750 to the 900s, you actually have very direct embassies, right, between the Tang dynasty, the Tang court, and the Abbasids. And the Indian Ocean route is, you know, is the big route of access there because Baghdad is, you know, has pretty good access to the Indian Ocean and, you know, the, you know, sort of area around Guangzhou and then Chuanzhou further up is, you know, is flourishing economic area. In the Song Dynasty, you don't have those direct embassies. There's first off, you know, where China is and where in the Islamic world they might be communicating with changes, right? So you have Northern Song embassies with the Karakhanids, right, who are a Central Asian power. And, you know, so the interesting question is how is that kind of contact and just contact in goods, right, movement of goods going to play out differently from an embassy going through the Indian Ocean, right? And, I mean, certainly this is a period where China starts to really become proverbial in Persian literature, right? You start getting a lot of references to China as a land of master craftsmen, as a place that, you know, one book that's been translated, Accounts of China in India, really, you know, describes in some detail the services provided by the Chinese state, right? That's in the 800s, but, you know, I think that same kind of idea persists and develops, and in the epic tradition in particular, right, and especially in the later epics after the Kushname, right, the Alexander epics, China comes to have an increasingly prominent role, right, that really takes off during the Mongol period, but in this period, it's, you know, I think it's already, you can already see signs of it, and I think one interesting thing is that there's a reference to Basila not having been conquered in thousands of years, and that's, I think, a pretty specific piece of, you know, bearing in mind it's speaking about a place that would be identified more with Korea than with China. I think it's a fairly significant piece of China lore, let's say, right? The image of China that you see attested in much later texts. So It's an interesting question, right? Because this, you know, this idea that Song China was producing almost industrial levels of iron by burning coal, right? I think that finding was found to be probably overstated, but it was, you know, an economic powerhouse. They were burning coal, and producing large amounts of iron. Porcelain is becoming a really big international good, and that's affecting ceramic production all over the Islamic world. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, and also, right, in Quanzhou and other cities, I think Hangzhou in this period, and other cities around kind of the southeast coast in Guangzhou, there's an increasing presence of a Muslim diaspora in China, and they're you know, becoming exam candidates. They're sort of becoming part of Chinese society, pretty important, right? They're pretty important there, and that kind of group is mediating contacts with the Islamic world.
So I want to, I think, end our interview by kind of noting, I guess noting something different, which is this work has never been translated before now. There's like one copy in the British Library. This translation only kind of came about because it mentions Korea. The Korean academics are very interested in translating this, but it hadn't been translated before now. You know, how much of Persian/Iranian/just history from this region throughout the Middle Ages, which I know is a contested term, how much of this history do we know about? How much of it do you think is still understudied, little understood?
It's a great question. I mean, there's always more to be done. And you're looking at broadly, right, when you're talking about Asian history, you're talking about, you know, most of the world that has received, you know, surely less than half of the, you know, the time and, resources that the study of medieval Europe has received, right? So, of course, there's a huge amount more to learn. It's not something where we can say we don't know anything, right? I mean, we have certainly the broad outlines of history, you know, political history and, you know, different aspects of material history for a lot of places. The history of contact, I think, though, is really and the history of the bigger picture, I think, is something that really we know way too little about. How do all of these different regions interact? What are the consequences? What's the significance of that interaction? There's somebody I think recently was awarded a writing grant to write a history of the Seljuk state, right? So we haven't had a focused history on the Seljuk Empire since, you know, I don't know when, right? But there hasn't been one written recently. And, there's also kind of a pen, you know, there's a lot of just literary treasures to be uncovered there, right? I mean, this is one of them. I mean, it's a weird, interesting book with, a character who is really unlike most of the epic heroes. And that results in a plot and a type of story that's really unlike most of the epic stories we see. And I think most of the action, as it were, is in the dramatic development, the storytelling, and not just wordplay, right, which is hard to translate. Yeah, I mean, there's also just this rich literary tradition that, apart from this idea that, you know, there's sort of a classical period and a post-classical period and a sort of literary canon that's developed, and the Kushnam is certainly outside of that literary canon.
So I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Kaveh Hemmat. I'm saying that again because I pronounced your name incorrectly. I'll try that again. One second. Thank you for listening to our conversation with Kaveh Hemmat, translator of the Kushnameh, the Persian epic of Kush the Tusk. Kaveh, I actually have, let's say, two more final questions for you, which is, where can people find your work and what's next for you?
Great. So this is available in online bookstores. You can get it on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, all those kinds of things. There's an ebook format and a paperback version available. It's only, what is it? The paperback price, I think, in the U.S. was about $25. So it's affordably priced. And you can ask your library to get a copy as well. Let's see. And for me, I mean, this, you know, interestingly, this was almost kind of, this is not the direction I intended to go in my research, because I'm primarily a historian interested in interaction between East Asia and the Islamic world. And one kind of hurdle I hit working on the Book of China, the Khatainameh, is a different book, you know, that I wrote my dissertation on and, you know, was working on after that, years after that, was the epic tradition seems to be a really important area of evidence, but I, you know, I need to learn it better. I need to learn to read it better. So this was almost kind of a detour from that. And you know, right now and in the near future, I'll be going back to working on just a variety of sources, writing about the process of contact between East Asia and the Islamic world. There's, you know, to put it briefly, we know that people talked, right? That news traveled and that information about distant places, you know, was carried around along with the goods, right? Along with silks and porcelains and things like that. We know that people knew about, you know, the Forbidden City and the Chinese Emperor and things like that. But what does, you know, what does that do for the politics, right? How did that affect the political history of the regions that were in contact, right? So really trying to write world history, you know, to write about East Asian Islamic world contact as a kind of world historical topic. Hopefully I'll have a book coming out on that soon. Details not quite worked out yet, but yeah.
Well, I mean, I look forward to hearing more about that when it's ready. So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And there are many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. The ARB podcast is on all favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends if you want to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Lachlan Fleetwood, author of Science on the Roof of the World, Empire and the Remaking of the Himalaya. But before then, thank you so much, Kaveh, for joining me today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.